Ok, alors, je vais peut-être commencer par 5 minutes de présentation en français du thème dont je vais parler après en anglais. Le thème dont je vais discuter, enfin, voilà, pour les personnes qui ne sont pas familières de ce problème philosophique, qui est le problème de l'amputation, comme on l'a appelé, c'est un problème en fait qui est très traditionnel, qui a été inventé, enfin, qui est discuté au moins depuis les stoïciens, dans la version stoïcienne que vous retrouverez dans les ouvrages sur l'histoire de la philosophie stoïcienne. C'est le problème traditionnel de Dion, ce qu'on appelle Dion et Théon. Dion étant un être humain dont on imagine par la pensée, enfin c'est un être humain en bonne santé qui a ses deux jambes, et on imagine par la pensée, on fait une découpe mentale de ce Dion en considérant la partie de cet être humain qui n'inclut pas sa jambe droite. Et les stoïciens nous disent, bah, imaginez que cette partie de Dion, nous l'appelons Théon. Théon, c'est la partie de Dion entier moins sa jambe droite. Et le problème de l'amputation consiste à dire la chose suivante: supposer que Dion soit amputé de sa jambe droite, eh bien après l'amputation, il semble que Dion a continué à exister. Dion, c'est l'être humain. On lui a coupé la jambe, hein, il a survécu à cette opération. Généralement, les êtres humains survivent à cette opération, enfin dans le meilleur des cas, une opération d'amputation de la jambe. Donc Dion a subsisté. Théon, la partie sans jambe droite, continue d'exister aussi, évidemment. Il lui est rien arrivé à cette partie-là. C'est l'autre partie, la jambe droite à laquelle il est arrivé quelque chose, mais la partie sans jambe droite, il ne lui est rien arrivé. Donc Dion continue d'exister, Théon continue d'exister, et pourtant, après l'amputation, le problème, c'est qu'il semble que Dion et Théon sont situés exactement au même endroit, sont des entités coïncidentes. Et tout le problème est de savoir si ces entités coïncidentes sont identiques, mais comment peuvent-elles être identiques si elles étaient distinctes avant l'amputation? Ou bien l'une des deux aurait-elle disparu? Ou bien est-ce que l'une des deux n'a jamais existé? Ou bien est-ce qu'il est possible pour deux entités distinctes d'être totalement coïncidentes matériellement, mais on a l'impression que c'est comme si on mettait deux Pierre et Paul au même endroit dans la pièce? C'est pas possible. Deux entités normalement matérielles s'excluent l'une l'autre. Donc voilà le problème de l'amputation dont je vais discuter. C'est un problème qui est discuté par Eric Olson. Attendez que je vous dise la référence exacte. Voilà. En fait, il en discute dans l'ordre inverse. Au lieu de voir un problème de diminution, il parle du problème de l'augmentation, mais ça pose exactement les mêmes problèmes philosophiques. Et ça se situe dans le chapitre 7, c'est la partie 7.3 du livre Que sommes-nous? Voilà, qui pose de nouveau enfin, voilà, qui pose bien les différentes réponses possibles à ce problème. Je vais continuer à présent en anglais pour envisager les différentes théories possibles qui prétendent que des entités peuvent coïncider comme Dion et Théon. So on the handout, I have stated the amputation scenario in a way a bit different from the Dion and Theon case, namely not. The scenario I'm considering is not one in which a guy is amputated of his leg, but a scenario in which a guy is amputated of all his body except his brain. I think that this avoids a certain number of problems, but I won't say exactly why I prefer this scenario. Probably Eric Olson does not prefer this scenario because he doesn't think that I can survive as a brain, but let's put this disagreement into parentheses for this talk. The amputation scenario is the following. So you have Bob before amputation. He's constituted by a number of organs and his brain, and then he's amputated of all his organs, and he seems to be now coincident with just his brain. And the amputation paradox can be stated as a list of five propositions that all seem intuitive, but cannot be accepted all at once. So the five propositions are the following. First, Bob and brain both exist before and after amputation. Second, Bob and brain are two distinct things before amputation. Three, Bob and brain are coincident
after amputation. 4. It is not possible for two distinct things to be coincident. And 5. Identity is a necessary relation. Which means that two things that are distinct cannot become identical. So in the literature, there are three main families of solution, and I will set aside one family of solutions, which was also set aside by Eric Olsen in his talk, namely the temporal parts view, but we can discuss about that in the discussion if you like. But I will concentrate on the three following families. One family of solution rejects premise one and says that Bob and or brain does not exist before or after amputation. So there are different versions of this view. Some hold that there are no composite objects at all. So neither Bob nor brain exist because there are just atoms and ways atoms are disposed, but there are no things composed of atoms. That's a strong form of eliminativism. A weaker kind of eliminativism is the one that Eric Olsen says he has some inclination towards, namely that brain does not exist before amputation. Why? Because before amputation, brain is a part that of Bob that is undetached. It's a part of an organism that is undetached from the organism, and undetached parts do not really exist. They are just abstract ways to consider things, but they are not real, actual material things out there in the world. So that's the rejection of undetached parts of organisms. This is also the view of Peter Fanning Weigand, for example. So that these are two kinds of eliminativisms, and not all eliminativisms are as radical as mereological nihilism, as we say, so as the rejection of any composite objects. But eliminativism is this is one family of views anyway. Second family of view, rejecting premise five, namely rejection of the idea that when two things are different, they cannot become identical. So some philosophers will want to say that, in fact, two things that are distinct can become identical in the metaphysical sense of identity, so being one and the same thing, numerical identity. And so identity is a temporal property and a contingent property that can be lost or acquired. Third family of views, and this is the family I will be discussing in this talk, the family of views which rejects premise four. So premise four is that it is not possible for two distinct things to be coincident. So this family of views says that it is possible for two distinct things to be coincident. It is possible for Dion and Theon to be two distinct things, even though they are completely coincident after amputation. And similarly for Bob and Brain, even though they are coincident after amputation, they are completely distinct things. So before I discuss the third family of views, namely coincident entities, I want to present another scenario, which is it could be considered as the dualist version of this amputation scenario. And you can think about it just like you would think about the difference between the scenario of brains in vats. In epistemology, for example, can I know that I'm not a brain in a vat, which is somehow analogous to Descartes' dualist scenario of the soul without a body that is manipulated by an evil demon. So you have in epistemology or philosophy of mind as well, you have these two scenarios, brains in vats and souls manipulated by the evil demon, One is the materialistic version of this scenario, the other the dualistic version. And so in just in the same way, you have here in the amputation case a materialistic scenario, which I just presented, and there is also a dualist version, which is the disembodiment scenario. So you can find this scenario, for example, in Achille Varzi's paper, his article on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy on Mereology. He says the following, so consider the view, it's on the handout, consider the view arguably held by Aquinas, according to which the human person survives physical death along with her soul, on the understanding that persons are hylomorphic composites and that two things cannot become one. The view implies that upon losing her body, a person will continue to exist pre-resurrection with only one proper part, namely the soul. So I will call Sally the disembodied person, and I will use the name, I will use soul as a name for her soul. So the problem of disembodiment is exactly parallel to the problem of amputation. First, it seems that Sally and soul both, well, at least if you're in the scenario of Aquinas, in this scenario, it seems that Sally and soul both exist before and after disembodiment. Second, that Sally and soul are two distinct things before disembodiment. That Sally and soul are coincident after disembodiment. But it's not possible for two distinct things to be coincident, and identity is a necessary relation, and you cannot hold these five propositions together for just the same reasons that 1 to 5 are not co-tenable in the amputation paradox. And of course, the three same families of solutions are open to the defender of the disembodiment scenario. The same views that are open to the defender of the amputation scenario. So let us now concentrate on the third family of views, namely coincident entities. What I want to draw attention on in this talk is that despite what we can usually get from reading literature on the subject, namely that there is just one coincident entities theory. In fact, there are three very different kinds of theories of coincident entities that are discussed in the literature, but not in the same context, and that's why they are not usually compared one with another. And the main intention of my talk is precisely to put them in comparison and in order to evaluate the relative merits of these three different views. So the three views, just to give their names, are the constitution view, which was also presented in Eric Olsen's talk. Second, the unique part view. And third, mereological hylomorphism. So I will present each of these views in detail just now. Before that, I want to say just one more point about why I keep in this discussion the scenario of the dualistic scenario of disembodiment, even though most philosophers nowadays wouldn't take seriously the metaphysical possibility or at least the plausibility of such a scenario. The reason is not that I want to defend here the plausibility of the scenario, but just that I think that there are some formal versions of the theory that give an interesting heuristic in presenting some versions of the coincident entity theories that are not discussed in the context of the paradox of amputation, even though they should, in my view. And basically, that's the case for the unique part view, which is discussed in the case of the disembodiment scenario, and not so much in the case of the amputation scenario. And I think that's a pity. And second, it's also a heuristic tool in order to understand the true nature of the third the third solution, namely a mereological hylomorphism. So I will use this disembodiment scenario in order to better understand what hylomorphists want to say and how they are or are not a solution to the problem. So let me start with the version of coincident entities, which is sometimes, well, perhaps often presented as the only kind of coincident entity theories, namely the constitution view. So it's important to have in mind that the constitution view was not first and originally created in response to the problem of imputation, but in response to another problem of coincident entities, namely the problem of the statue and the clay, which was also presented by Eric Olson. So you probably still have in mind the scenario of the statue. Whose was it? A statue of?
So David Bowie.
David Bowie.
I try and find it.
So the statue of David Bowie, which starts its career as a pure lump of clay, and then a statue comes into existence, and then it's squashed back into a mere lump of clay. So that's the scenario. And here is what the constitution view says about this scenario. So there are three tenets of the constitution view. First, on my paper, it was not a David Bowie, it was a statue of Goliath, so I will go on with Goliath. And the lump of clay also has a name. It's a very special lump of clay. It has the privilege of having a name. It's called Lumpel. And so, first tenet of the view, Lumpel and Goliath coincide. And they coincide not only in terms of spatial location, they're exactly in the same place, but they also coincide in terms of their parts. I will say more about that later. Second, in spite of being coincident, they are not identical. So this is why the view is a coincident entities view. And third, rather, Lumpel and Goliath stand in a special relation, which is called constitution. And one thing which is difficult in constitution theory is that different constitutionalists have different views about what this special property is, but they seem to all agree that this special relation should be called constitution. So anyway, I will comment briefly on these three tenets. First, what do I mean by saying that the two things coincide in terms of their parts? What is mereological coincidence? For this kind of coincidence, there are two definitions, a strict one and a loose one. The strict one is the one given by Eric Olson in his book. I can read it very quickly, but really, in order to really understand it, we would have to take a long time, so I won't do that here, so I'll just read it quickly. X coincides mereologically with Y if and only if some things, the Z's, compose X and also compose Y. So that's the strict definition, and it's not logically equivalent to the second definition, but the second definition is nonetheless the one that is often used by mainstream constitution theorists. So I will identify constitution theory with the view that accepts the second definition, namely the loose definition that X and Y have all and only the same parts. What does it mean to say that David Bowie or Goliath coincides with the lump of clay? It means that any atom that is a part of the lump of clay is a part of Goliath, and any atom that is a part of Goliath is a part of the lump of clay. And any bunch of atoms that is a part of Goliath is also a part of the lump, and vice versa. So they have exactly the same parts. Or, to be more precise, the same proper parts, because, of course, they're not parts of each other. So that's mereological coincidence as it is traditionally understood by constitution theorists, namely sharing all the same parts. Second, what does it mean to say that such coincident entities are distinct? What does it imply in terms of the logics of parthood? Well, what it implies is the rejection of a very important principle of the traditional logic of parthood, traditional Mariology, namely the principle of extensionality, or more precisely, the sufficiency conditions of extensionality. So here is what the principle says. If X and Y have all the same proper parts, then they are identical. So if the logical formulation is easier for you to read, it's for all Z, if Z is a proper part of X, and Z is, if and only if Z is a proper part of Y, then X is identical to Y. So that's the price of the constitution view. The price is to abandon extensionality as a sufficiency condition. It becomes possible for two things to be distinct even though they have exactly the same proper parts. And many traditional logicians of parthood will be unhappy with that. Third condition, what is exactly this special relation, which is called constitution? We now know that it's a special relation that holds between two things that have all their parts in common. But of course, it cannot be just that. Why? Well, because when X has all the same parts as Y, Y also has all the same parts as X. So sharing all the same parts is not only a reflexive, but also a symmetric relation. And constitution is not. It's not possible for X to constitute Y and Y to constitute X. And it's not possible for X to constitute X. So constitution cannot just be the sharing of all of one's parts. And also, it's important to see that the reason why constitution is asymmetric is not grounded on the asymmetry of parthood. So the reason why it is Lumpel that constitutes Goliath and not Goliath that constitutes Lumpel is not that Lumpel is a part of Goliath and Goliath is not a part of Lumpel. So it's very important to see that in traditional constitution view, when X constitutes Y, X is not a part of Y. The relation between X and Y is a completely different kind of relation and not a relation of parthood. So let us see how this view applies to the problems of imputation and disembodiment. So I have given two pictures. The first picture is about the problem of imputation, and it's like Arabic, it reads from right to left. You should look first at the top and right hand side of the picture, namely what happens after imputation. After imputation, Bob is coincident with Brain. This is what we know from the general theory of coincident entities. So how is the constitutionalist going to explain the coincidence of Bob and Brain? Here is how. So suppose that Brain has two parts, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. So I write them LH and RH. After imputation, the Brain has exactly the same parts as Bob, which means that the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere are also parts of Bob. And all parts that are parts of Bob are parts of Brain, and all parts that are parts of Brain are parts of Bob. So this is what I represented on the right-hand side of the picture. You have Bob and Brain, and the arrows represent the relation of parthood, and you see that all the things that are parts of one are parts of the other, and vice versa. Between Bob and Brain, I could have added another link, but what is important to see is that there is no relation of parthood between them. There is just this special relation of constitution. And part of what it means is that they have all their parts in common. So part of what it means to constitute is represented by the arrows under them. So that's what happens after amputation. But then, in order to account for the scenario, you also have to account for what happens before amputation. And before amputation, it seems obvious that the constitutionalists will have to say that brain was a part of Bob, a proper part of Bob. And Bob had other proper parts, namely his organs. So now I have represented on the left-hand side what happens before the amputation. You have organs and brain that are both proper parts of Bob. But presumably, if you're a constitutionalist, you will want to say that there is something else with which Bob coincided before amputation, something by which it was constituted, even if it was not constituted by his brain. So what was it? Probably it was something like his body. And his body, because it was what constituted Bob before amputation, had the same parts as Bob had, namely his organs and his brain. So this is the scenario of amputation according to the constitutionalists. Before amputation, brain is a proper part of Bob and a proper part of what constitutes Bob. And after amputation, what happens is that brain ceases to be a part of Bob and becomes, it takes the place of body by becoming what constitutes Bob. So I hope the scenario is clear enough with the pictures. Let us turn now to what the disembodiment theorist might say in response. And I will just show briefly that it's just, well, in principle at least, the disembodiment scenario could be explained exactly formally analogical way. The only difficulty is that we will have to suppose that the soul has proper parts. And of course, if you're a traditional Cartesian dualist, you will think that probably the soul doesn't have proper parts. And so it might be difficult to say what it is for an atom, a mereological atom like a soul, to coincide with something else if it doesn't have proper parts at all. How is it possible to share the same proper parts if you don't have proper parts? So that's a problem which is really peripheral to what I want to discuss here. So I will just make the assumption, the Platonic assumption, if you like, that souls have proper parts. So for Plato, souls have three parts. I will retain only two parts of the Platonic parts just to make the schema simpler. So let's say that the soul has a logical part and what is the second part? Appetitive, yes, thank you. The appetitive part. And so after disembodiment, what happens is that these two parts of the soul become all and the same parts that are parts of the of Sally. And so Sally and soul share all the same proper parts after disembodiment. But what happens before disembodiment is again that soul was a proper part of Sally, and probably it was also proper part of something that did constitute Sally before disembodiment, which I call here, for lack of a better term, a human being or a human. So I think you can see very easily from just seeing at the pictures that the two schemas are just formally equivalent, even though, of course, they are not equivalent in terms of the plausibility of the scenario. So much for the constitution theory of what happens. Let us turn now to the unique part view. So the unique part view, what is important to notice is that it's very it's very seldom discussed in the context of the amputation paradox. So there are a few philosophers who do discuss it in the context of an amputation paradox, like Jonathan Lowe, for example. But mainly, this is a version of the coincident entities theories that is mostly discussed in the context of the disembodiment scenario. And there are reasons for that, but I think these are just historical and accidental reasons, and I will show why. So I will start with the disembodiment scenario nonetheless in order to give you an idea of how it is presented in the literature. So here is the reasoning that is behind the unique part view of disembodiment. Here is how a unique part theorist will describe what happens during disembodiment. So this is also on the handout. So before disembodiment, Sally is made of soul and body. Sally has two parts, a soul and a body. And at the moment of death, one of these things she's made of is suppressed, namely the body. There is a separation of body and soul, and Sally follows her soul, so to speak. But she is still made of what is left. In other words, she is still made of the soul. In fact, she becomes made of the soul alone. She has lost the relation she had towards the body. She is not made of the body anymore. But she hasn't lost the relation that she had towards her soul. Therefore, soul remains a part of Sally, even though it becomes the only part of Sally. This is the kind of reasoning which you will find in the works of Eleanor Stump, or Hershenhoff and Co-Hershenhoff, and also in Oderberg. So, and I have made a small picture to make this view more clearer. It's very easy, a very easy picture. So before disembodiment, Sally has two proper parts, body and soul, and after disembodiment, Sally loses the proper part relation to the body, and it retains only the proper part relation to the soul, so it has only one proper part. The consequence of that view is that it is possible for something to have a unique proper part. And this is something that goes against another principle of classical mereology, or the classical logic of parthood, namely what is called by logicians the weak supplementation principle. Roughly, I won't give the technical details here, but what the weak supplementation principle says is that if X is a proper part of Y, then there is in Y a supplement to X. So that means that there is in Y another proper part of Y, which is disjoint from X, which does not overlap X, if you're reading the logical formulation of it. So it is important to understand that if the constitution view is the version of the view which violates extensionality, the unique part view is the view, the version of the view that violates weak supplementation. So each of these two views violates one important principle of classical mereology, but not the same principle. And in fact, it could be shown very quickly that each of these views violates only this principle and not the other. Of course, if one of the two views violated the two principles together and the other violated only one of these principles, it would be easy to choose. But here, one violates supplementation and the other violates extensionality, but not vice versa. So this, again, as I said, this view is usually presented in the discussion of disembodiment scenario, but I think this is a mere accident of history, and it shouldn't be so. It should be discussed also in the treatment of the problem of amputation, as Achille Varzi rightly states in his Stanford Encyclopedia entry, when he says the following: indeed, any case of material coincidence resulting from mereological diminution, as in the Stoic puzzle of Dion and Theon, and its modern variant of Tibbles and Tib, would seem to be at odds with supplementation. After the diminution, or the amputation, there is nothing that makes up for the difference between what was a proper part and the whole with which it comes to coincide. I think that is just exactly right, that we should be discussing the unique part view as one version of coincident entities in the case of amputation scenarios. And here is how the amputation paradox would be interpreted in that case. So before amputation, what happens is that Bob has two proper parts, namely his organs. Well, I conjoin all organs as one proper part, and the brain. So organs is everything but the brain, if you like. From these two proper parts, one of them is suppressed during the amputation process. What is left is just one proper part of Bob, namely the brain. Now, if you want to be precise, of course, you will remark that the left hemisphere is still a proper part of Bob as well. So in strict terms, Bob has still more than one proper part. He has at least brain, left hemisphere, and right hemisphere. So he doesn't have just one proper part. He has at least three. But the fact is that brain is as a proper part without supplement. And that's what is important from a logical point of view. It's not acceptable for classical mereology to have a proper part which is not supplemented by other proper parts. So that's the second kind of coincident views, coincident entities view. It's possible for two things to be coincident when one is the only proper part of the other, or the only proper part, or a proper part without supplement. It's not the case in this view that Bob and brain have all their proper parts in common, because brain is a proper part of Bob, but Bob is not a proper part of Bob. So they don't have the same, but brain is not a proper part of brain, sorry. So there is a proper part of one that is not a proper part of the other. So they don't violate extensionality. They don't have the same proper parts. But one is the only proper part of the other, and so that's violating weak supplementation. So far we have seen two theories, two versions of coincident entities that violate two different principles of classical mereology, namely extensionality and weak supplementation. And what is interesting in the third view is that it does not violate either extensionality nor weak supplementation. And in fact, as far as I'm aware, it doesn't violate any principle of classical mereology. Maybe perhaps unrestricted composition, but that's another issue. Anyone wants to reject unrestricted composition? Not anyone. So, mereological hylomorphism. So one might think, how is it possible to a certain extent, it would seem to be a perfect solution. It's a solution that violates none of the principles that logicians would want to retain. So here is the core idea of mereological hylomorphism. And again, it's important to be aware that this version of the view was crafted not on the amputation paradox, but on the problem of the statue and the clay, just like the constitution view. So I will start again from the statue and the clay problem. And here is what the mereological hylomorphist wants to say about the statue and the clay. He wants to say that, well, she wants to say, because it's mainly Catherine Kosliky who defends this view, she wants to say that Lumpel and Goliath coincide spatially, but not mereologically in any of the senses we've considered so far. First, they coincide spatially because they have all their material parts in common. And the place or the spatial location of a thing is determined by its material parts. But Goliath has a form in the sense of Aristotelian hylomorphism. It has a form which Lumpel doesn't have. And this is what makes it into mereological hylomorphism, properly speaking, and not traditional hylomorphism. And This form is a part of Goliath in the strict sense of Mariology. The form, the Aristotelian form of Goliath, of the statue, is a part of the statue alongside with the material parts. This is the strong claim, the strong invention of Catherine Kosliki. And this is
it's easy to see why there is no Mariological coincidence between Goliath and Lumpel. They don't coincide in terms of their parts, because there is a part of one which is not a part of the other, namely the formal part. The form is a part of Goliath and not a part of Lumpel. They have only their material parts in common, but not their formal parts. So they don't coincide in terms of their parts. They coincide only in terms of their spatial location. But maybe that's sufficient to say that they're coincident, and that it's a coincident entity solution nonetheless. So let us apply this solution to the case of amputation and disembodiment. This would mean that before amputation, Bob not only has two material parts, which are his brain and his organs, but he also has a formal part. And for now, I will just call it the form. So Bob has three parts: form, organs, and brain. And what happens after amputation is that the organs are suppressed, and Bob is reduced to the two parts, form and brain. And now you see that here, we are not saying that there is some part, some former part of Bob with which Bob becomes coincident, because he still has two parts at least, form and brain. So this is basically the picture for amputation. And the same picture, again, from a purely formal point of view, the same form of picture could be applied to the disembodiment scenario. That would mean that Sally, before disincarnation or before disembodiment, has three parts: her body, her soul, and a form which unites the body and the soul in order to make the human person. And after disembodiment, what happens is that the form remains, the soul remains, but the body part is suppressed. So we still have two proper parts, form and soul. Now, of course, if you are familiar with traditional hylomorphism, you will find this picture very weird, because traditional hylomorphism in Aristotle's version or in Aquinas' version has it that the form of a human person is her soul. So it's not possible for Sally to have two proper parts, her soul and her form. That would be just one proper part, because the form is identical with the soul. The form just is the soul. So the kind of hylomorphism I'm presenting here as a solution for the hylomorphist is not traditional hylomorphism, which I call soul-body hylomorphism, where the soul is the form of the person. That would be a kind of hylomorphism where the soul is, so to speak, a material part of the person, not a physical part, of course, but a material part in the sense of hylomorphic matter. It's a material part of the person, and the formal part of the person is not the soul, but something else, something that unites the soul with the body. But let us just set this non-traditional hylomorphism to aside. What is more interesting here is that is the amputation paradox. If you say that traditional hylomorphism is one in which the soul is the form of the person, then instead of form in the first picture, what you should have written is soul, that Bob is made of soul, organs, and brain. And then after amputation, Bob would be made of soul and brain. But then, of course, you see where we are going here. If you think that it's possible for the soul to remain as the only part of the person, then the person could be amputated one step more.
it could be amputated of the brain as well, and we would be reduced, we would be reducing the problem of amputation to the problem of disembodiment. And that's why I think the problem of disembodiment is interesting to keep in mind here. In order to see that hylomorphism will be a solution to the problem, only if the hylomorphist says that the person cannot be reduced to her soul. If the hylomorphist accepts, like Aquinas does, that a person can be reduced to her form, to her soul, then the hylomorphism is not a solution at all to the amputation paradox. Because you could amputate the person one step more, amputate it of her brain, and you would have to say that the relation between her form and herself is some one of the two theories we've seen before. They will be coincident mariologically that time. So I hope it's clear why the reduction to the disembodiment problem shows how mirological hylomorphism can be a solution and how it cannot. So I want to present, maybe just one argument against each of these views. And basically, I will be defending that the view that has the weakest argument against it is the unique part view. So let me start with one argument against the constitution view. I will skip the first argument, the argument from asymmetry. For those who have read the paper, I would be very interested to know what you think about this argument, because I'm less confident about it than about the second one. I will present only the lost, what I call the lost part argument. In a very simple presentation, the lost part argument says the following. If you remember the picture I have given for the constitution view, what I have said is that before amputation, Bob is constituted by a body and has brain, has a proper part. And then after amputation, brain becomes what constitutes Bob. But, and this is what is important, but brain is not a part of Bob anymore. This is what traditional constitution view must hold, that Bob ceases to be a part, that brain ceases to be a part of Bob. And this I find intuitively problematic. So here is a first way to present it, and then I will elaborate on this intuition. So the first version is a very simple one. The constitution view is committed to saying that Bob loses his brain part during the amputation. Second, but brain is precisely the part that Bob doesn't lose during the amputation. Of course, Bob loses his organ parts, but brain is the part that Bob doesn't lose. So it's very weird to say that brain ceases to be a part of Bob. So I think with this intuitive presentation of the argument, the constitutionalist will not be very impressed, I suspect. He will say that it is confusing. Well, I'm imagining what she should say. Probably she would say that it's misleading to say that Bob loses his brain part. What happens is that Bob ceases to have the parthood relation to brain, but it doesn't lose his brain in any relevant sense of the verb to lose. On the contrary, brain is retained as a constituent and not anymore as a part. So maybe this response would indicate that the lost part objection is just playing with words, with the word to lose a part. But I think that the objection goes deeper than that. So basically, what I think the objection, in more technical terms, I think the objection is the following, that parthood, that it is weird to say that
Bob loses any kind of relation to brain in the process of amputation, because it seems that nothing happens between the relation between Bob and brain. What happens is something about the relation between Bob and organs, but between Bob and brain, instead, that the same relations continue to hold. And in order to make this intuition more precise, we would have to make the distinction between an intrinsic relation and an extrinsic relation. So instead of reading the official definition, I think it would be easier with an example. So suppose Romeo is a lover of Juliet, and Tebaldeo is also a lover of Juliet. So there are two things that have the relation B is a lover of towards Juliet. Is a lover of, this relation between Romeo and Juliet has nothing to do with what happens to Tebaldeo or anyone else. It has to do only with what happens to Romeo and to Juliet. But notice that if we're in this scenario, Romeo also has the following property, being he is one among other lovers of Juliet. This is another relation that Romeo has towards Juliet. He is one among other lovers of Juliet because of Tebaldeo. And this relation is a relation that Romeo has to Juliet in virtue of other things outside Romeo and Juliet. So it is a relation which we call extrinsic, a relation that two things have between them because in virtue of what happens to other things outside of them. And the opposite of an extrinsic relation is the intrinsic relation, like is a lover of, and an intrinsic relation is one that two things have, not in virtue of other things outside of them, but only in virtue of them and what happens between them. So I think this the example can make sufficiently clear what the difference is between extrinsic and intrinsic relation. And the intuition that we had about the relation between Bob and brain, more precisely, is that it doesn't seem that Bob and brain lose any intrinsic relation between them. Maybe they lose extrinsic relation, things that happen in virtue of what happens to other things, in particular things that happen to organs, but they don't lose any intrinsic relation between them. And if you think that parthood is an intrinsic relation, it will follow that that Bob cannot lose the parthood relation towards brain. So actually, I think the burden of this argument lies on saying that parthood is an intrinsic relation. Maybe the constitution theorist will want to deny that parthood is an intrinsic relation. But then, which extrinsic relation could parthood be? I think what the constitution theorist might have in mind is something like this. Just in the same kind of way that Romeo can have the relation is one among other lovers of Juliet, similarly, brain could have towards Bob the relation is one among other what it's made of. It's not the only what it's made of Bob, but it's one among others, one among other what it's made of, so to speak. So maybe that's the kind of extrinsic relation that the brain has towards Bob before amputation. Now, if that is the case, what is important to realize is that often, I would think in most cases, in most natural cases, extrinsic relations are grounded in intrinsic relations. So, for instance, if Romeo has the relation, is one among other lovers of Juliet, it's because he has, it's in virtue of having the more fundamental relation, is a lover of Juliet. If he were not a lover of Juliet, he couldn't be one among other lovers of Juliet. So, similarly, I think that if the parthood relation is to be one among other what it's made of, then it will be grounded in a more fundamental relation, which is
to be a what it's made of. Not among others, just to be a what it's made of. And the only problem is that if you say that about the relation of parthood, then it seems that what the constitution theorists will have to say about the constitution relation is that this constitution relation can be translated as the following. What it is for X to constitute Y? Well, it just means that X is the only what it's made of Y. It used to be, so for example, brain used to be one among others, one among other what it's made of, and it becomes the only what it's made of Y. This other relation, being the only what it's made of, just like being the only lover of Juliet, is an extrinsic relation. It's a relation that Romeo could gain if he kills Tebaldeo, for example. He will become, extrinsically, the only lover of Juliet. So it's an extrinsic relation, and because it's an extrinsic relation, it's not a fundamental relation, but a relation that is derivative upon the more fundamental and intrinsic relation to be a what it's made of. It would follow that constitution is not a fundamental relation and a brute relation that cannot be defined in any other relation. And this is something that constitution theorists don't want to say. So here we have a direct argument against constitution theorists. If they want to say that parthood is an extrinsic relation, they will have to say that constitution is also an extrinsic relation, and if it is so, then it's not a fundamental relation. The fundamental relation will be the relation what it's made of.
I'm running a bit out of time, so maybe I will just make the argument against... I will just show the argument against the unique part view, and I will not present the last part on the true nature of mereological hylomorphism. I think that the heart of the discussion is between these two views anyway. So maybe it's not so important to abandon the third view. So very quickly, the objection against the unique part view, as we have seen before, is that it violates the intuition of supplementation. And many mereologists, many logicians or philosophers of parthood think that supplementation is not only a true matter of fact, but it's an analytic truth about parthood. Something that if you don't accept supplementation, it's just that you're confused about the notion we're talking about. You have not understood the notion. So I've tried to formulate a bit more clearly this intuition of analyticity. This is what I call the partial objection. So suppose we concentrate not on the word part, and especially not on the word, the countable word, a part or two parts, etc., but on the words that are derived, the adverbs or the adjectives like partial or partially. When you say that something is partial, it seems to imply analytically that it's not complete. When you say that something is partially read, it implies analytically that it's not completely read, it's not fully read, etc. So it does seem that the words derived from the linguistic stem part contain analytically the notion of a supplement, of supplementation, of another part. That's the way I can personally share the intuition of supplementation. But I think this intuition, this objection, is not conclusive for the following reason. First, we have to be aware that if you accept this intuition of supplementation, it directly follows that parthood is an extrinsic relation. Because it will follow that something is a part of another in virtue of there being another part outside of the two things that are part of each other. So it does follow that
something cannot be a part of another just in virtue of what happens between them, but only partly in virtue of what happens to some other things outside of them. So I think it's important to be aware of that. If you buy into the supplementation intuition, you have to accept that it directly follows that parthood is an extrinsic relation. And therefore, I think what the lesson to draw from that is that we are not faced with one intuition in one direction. We are actually faced with a conflict of two intuitions. The intuition of what I call the partial objection, the partial intuition, the partiality intuition, and on the other hand, the intuition that parthood is an intrinsic relation. And I think these two intuitions are just as important one as the other, and we cannot just make as if one were the only intuition and the only thing we should take into account. Now, when we are aware that there are these two conflicting intuitions, then I think we are in front of a conflict between two possible meanings of the word part. We are in front of a case of linguistic ambiguity. And it is an ambiguity between the following two meanings of the word part, namely, the ones we have just seen, being one among others, other what it's made of, or being a what it's made of. And I think that this conflict of intuition reveals that we tend to use the word part in either of these two meanings. We tend to use part sometimes as meaning one among other what it's made of, and sometimes as meaning being a what it's made of. And there is no way, because of this linguistic ambiguity, what we must do is a kind of philosophical regimentation of natural language. We have to choose between these two conflicting meanings for the word part. And I think the good regimentation is to use the word part, which is a fundamental word of probably all natural languages, for the concept that is the most fundamental and the one that we don't want to be defined in terms of other terms, but the one that would be used to define other terms. And obviously, if the ambiguity is between A and B, being one among other what it's made of, or being A what it's made of, it's much more natural to use the word part to mean the second property, the second relation, and to define the first in terms of the other. If you say that being a part is being A what it's made of, then the first will be simply defined as being one among other parts. Now, if you think that there are these two different meanings of part, you could make a Mariology too, so to speak, for the second meaning, being one among other parts. But the real Mariology we're interested in is the one with the most fundamental meaning of part, namely being A what it's made of, and this meaning does not satisfy weak supplementation. So that's why I think the argument against weak supplementation is not a very strong one, whereas there is a strong argument against the constitution view, namely the lost part argument. And given the fact that if I had time to show it, the third view is not actually a view of coincident entities, but another kind of view, it follows that between these only two views of coincident entities, the one that seems to win the game is the unique part view. Thank you.